All right, let's get settled in. And we will be in the book of Zechariah tonight. So we are moving very quickly towards the end of the Old Testament. Our 12 minor prophets. This is number 11. So next week will be number 12. We will be finished with this section. What we'll do next week is I'm going to open up to suggestions about what maybe we study next. So if you have something that you've been dying to study or you would want to know more about, be thinking about that over the next week, and we'll kind of do like a little suggestion box. That way I can just ignore you if I don't like your suggestion, and don't have to be rude to you in front of the whole group. But think about what you want to study. Think about if there's something out there that you've always wanted to study that we've never really gotten around to. And I know it's hard to find stuff that we haven't studied because we've got so many people going through so many different things in different parts of this church at any given time that it's hard to find stuff that we haven't covered yet. But if there is something that we haven't covered yet that you think we should study, then I want you to put that in the suggestion box next week. All right, so title of the lesson is The Apocalypse of the Old Testament. And anytime you throw the word apocalypse in there, it sounds kind of intense. I think that's kind of a cool word. And what we're going to do before we get into the scriptures is we're going to try to figure out what this whole apocalypse thing means. And Zechariah is kind of known as the apocalypse of the Old Testament. A lot of times when we think apocalypse, you probably think Revelation, but Zechariah is known as apocalyptic literature, and we're going to talk about what that means tonight. So, if you remember last week, what prophet did we look at last week? Haggai, yes, we saw Haggai last week. So, remember at the end, why do I have this ridiculous picture of Batman and Robin on the screen? Yeah, I would guess that Zechariah is more of the Batman to Haggai's Robin. Remember, we talked about Haggai and Zechariah being kind of the dynamic duo that they prophesy together, especially in the early part of their ministry. And what we'll see is the second half of stuff that we're going to cover with Zechariah, he prophesied that much later. But the beginning of his ministry, the first eight chapters of Zechariah and all of Haggai take place in about the same time. They're prophesying together. When you look at the book of Ezra, it talks about the prophets Zechariah and Haggai. They're always together. Okay? So that's why we've got crazy, corny Batman and Robin picture up there, because they are kind of the dynamic duo. So we're going to start with a little bit of a rabbit trail, and I hope it's an informative one. But we're not going to jump right into Zechariah yet, because like I said, I want to talk about apocalyptic literature. And that sounds like a really big word, and you know, you're getting really confused and scared that that's what we're going to be talking about. But let's talk about apocalyptic literature. Okay, and if you're a comic book guy, that's apocalypse right there. I've got a little toy, a figure of him at home, if anybody wants to see it. It's really awesome. Along with my Silver Surfer figure that goes along with him. It's cool. The Silver Surfer, you can pull back his surfboard and he'll go along the counter. It's great. All right. So, does anybody have any idea what apocalypse means? Ty. What? The end of the world. That's a. You're in the right ballpark. Okay. What else? What else do you think about with apocalypse? Heather? End times? Bethany? Right. But Revelation is probably the ultimate apocalyptic book. Okay, well, let's look at this term and see what this means, because it's a Greek word. Okay, it always goes back to the Greek, right? But it's a Greek word, and it means uncovering. It's like we just unveiled it. We took the veil off, we took the sheet off, we showed you what was really there. It was covered up before, now it's uncovered. Okay, so what is apocalyptic literature? If it is an uncovering, what is apocalyptic literature? Because it's very easy to misunderstand what it is. Right. Apocalyptic literature is not intended to provide an answer for every question about the future. Like, if you've ever read the book of Revelation, it's not like you read that and you walk away and go, okay, I know everything's going to happen now. I got it. I got it figured out. That's very clear. Hey, there are guys with multiple doctorates arguing over what's going on in Revelation. It's pretty complex stuff. Right? So that's not what apocalyptic literature is. It's not open it up and you get all the answers and now we can move forward. You get some answers, but you don't get everything. It's all about hope. It's about the hope for the future. That's what we see with all these prophets in the Old Testament. It's a highly symbolic form of historical narrative. That's kind of some big words. So historical means what? Could be what else? If it's history versus fantasy, yes, history actually happens, right? So it's historical. So it's kind of weird because apocalyptic literature often looks what? Forward. And yet it's historical. Why? Because it's actually going to happen. Okay? Narrative. What does narrative mean? Okay, it's a story, right? So a historical story, a telling of what is actually going to happen. So when we see, when you read Revelation and you see John talking about all this crazy stuff that he sees in Revelation, it's not like he's just having a crazy dream. Okay? John is literally taken into the future so he can look at what's happening. And he's describing it the best way that he can. He's seeing actual events. You know, it's kind of like before, if we move back and we look at, we look at a lot of Daniel stuff. He's interpreting dreams. He's interpreting visions. He's seeing these different things. John has a little different experience. John is seeing things as they happen, right? Which is kind of hard to wrap your mind around, but that's what's happening there. They're real events depicted in detailed symbolic language. Okay, so if John was taken forward, think about where we are now in society, and we haven't even gotten to Revelation yet in our history. And John lived over 2,000 years ago. What do you think all the stuff he saw looked like to him? Can you imagine John seeing airplanes and helicopters and armies and tanks and crazy stuff like that? How in the world would he be able to describe that? That's why we see some of the stuff that he describes. He just can't even put it into words, what he sees. But think about how weird that would look 2,000 years ago if somebody showed you an airplane. I'd imagine you'd be pretty surprised what that is. Right, what apocalyptic literature is, it's a picture of what the future holds. What it's not is specific details of its fulfillment. So if somebody comes along and tells you they've got the code cracked, they're not telling you the truth. Hey, I know when it's going to happen. I know how it's going to go down. No, you don't. Hey, no, you don't. We've seen plenty of people mess up on that. Seniors, you guys have studied a couple of religions in your class already about people that have thought they could predict the end, and they're kind of dumb because they can't, you know. Isn't it funny with those guys as they're like, it's going to happen in 1916, and then it doesn't happen. They're like, oh, I missed 1918, and then it doesn't happen again. They're like, 1921, and then they don't have a church much after that. And yet there's still people in the church, which boggles my mind. How does that, once he misses two or three times, you kind of got to think, maybe he's not talking to God. Symbols and features of the visions are incidental. So if you think about apocalyptic literature, think about the book of Daniel. Think about some of the visions that Daniel has. Okay? Are they normal visions? Think about some of the animals that he sees with multiple heads and multiple wings and crazy horns growing out of their heads and stuff like that. All right? So these are symbolic. Okay? It's highly symbolic in the visions. Apocalyptic texts usually provide their own interpretation. Apocalyptic texts usually draw on events depicted literally elsewhere in the Bible, like the promises to Israel, which we'll talk about a little bit tonight. Apocalyptic texts are often explained in later biblical books. So we get a vision in Daniel. We get confirmation of a lot of that stuff in Revelation. Okay, so when Daniel's talking about his 70 weeks, we get the 70th week there in Revelation. And we get a confirmation later on. The prophet's message is not hidden in uninterpreted symbols. You don't need the Joseph Smith magic plates or read through your hat to try to figure out what's being said. Okay, it is there. It's just not always clear when it's first presented. Okay, but the truth is there. And while some mystery remains, prophecies are very specific in nature. So we're not talking about one of these ideas. It's kind of like this fraud that's on TV. I'm thinking there is a person that died. It was a man. He had hair. You know, like, it's not that kind of, yeah. He had two arms. He liked to eat food. It's not that kind of, yeah, that's right, yeah. He loved food. He ate three meals a day. You know, it's not. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not a psychic medium sort of generalities kind of thing. It's very specific. So when Daniel tells us about these specific things that he sees, they are related to specific events. And the more specific you are with prophecy, the harder it is to fake that prophecy. Right? So when we talk about, remember we talked about the one a couple weeks ago with when Jeremiah prophesied 70 years of captivity in Babylon. And from the time that they leave Jerusalem in 586 and come back in 516 to finish the construction of the temple, it is 70 years. it's hard to fake a perfect round number like that, and that's exactly what we see going on, specific prophecy that gets fulfilled. Okay, so we're going to get back on topic because the most interesting man in the world says so. All right, who is Zechariah? Okay, his nickname is Big Z. We're tight. So Big Z Zechariah. Zechariah prophesies between 520 and 480 B.C. Okay, 520 and 480 B.C. His name means the Lord remembers. And his book is second only to Isaiah in the breadth of the prophet's writings about the Messiah. So if you want to read about the coming Messiah in the Old Testament, the first place you would go would be Isaiah. The second place you would go is Zechariah. If you're looking for the amount of prophecy concerning Jesus Christ, Zechariah is second behind Isaiah. Okay, we're all very familiar with Isaiah, right? What chapter specifically would we run to probably for messianic prophecy? 53, Isaiah 53, right? That's what we would run to, and we would know those verses. They would be very familiar. But we're going to look at Zechariah tonight and see very specific verses, just like Isaiah gives us in 53 and other places as well, that are very specific to the coming Messiah, the first coming and the second coming. Okay, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, Zechariah is a priest. So he's a prophet and a priest. And according to tradition, he was a member of the Great Synagogue. That's a council of 120 guys originated by Nehemiah, presided over by Ezra, and that group eventually becomes the Sanhedrin. And so this is the guy that is he's in the spiritual leadership of Israel. He's top of the line, smart guy, priestly lineage, knows about God, knows the scriptures, and he's going to be the one that, you know, this thing started, this great synagogue kind of started as a good idea, and then it turns into the Sanhedrin. But it started as a noble pursuit, and then we kind of lose our way very soon after that. Zechariah is born in Babylon while they're in captivity. So he is not born in Israel. He's born in Babylon. And he comes back with his grandfather. And you can read about this exile in Ezra. His grandfather's name is Iddo. Okay, isn't that a great name? And he's in the exiles that come back under Zerubbabel. Another great name. And we talked about him last week. Zerubbabel. The leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua. So when he comes back in 536, I'm in there somewhere, when he comes back with Zerubbabel. And his opening words are dated from 520 B.C. So he's been in the land for about 16, 18 years. And remember, when Ezra and those guys come back, their first priority is to do what in Jerusalem? Build what? The temple. They need to rebuild the temple. And what happens is when they get there, they start rebuilding the temple, they get the foundations laid, everybody's all excited, and then they start getting opposition, the people in the land start to rise up against them, and they just stop building. And it's not until 520, when Haggai and Zechariah show up and start prophesying that they need to rebuild the temple, that it gets done. And so he is part of the impetus to get this temple built from 520 to 516. Okay? He began prophesying 2 months after Haggai. And he's called a young man in Zechariah 2:4, so he's probably younger than Haggai. So not only are they the dynamic duo, sort of, okay? Haggai's the older, more respected, you know, elder kind of guy, and Zechariah is the young, energetic, you know, kind of guy. So we've got an interesting dynamic with these two guys coming in to preach. Now, the length of his ministry is uncertain. The last dated prophecy came approximately 2 years after the first, making them identical at the time of Haggai's prophecy. So he prophesies for 2 years, 520 to 518. Right? Chapters 9 through 14 in Zechariah, because if you think about it, with these minor prophets, they've been pretty short books, right? And we've been talking about very small chapters. Some of them we've even hit one chapter, like Obadiah. All right? And so this is a 14-chapter book. That's pretty long for a minor prophet. And so we've got a much bigger thing here. And from 9 to 14, he prophesied that much later. So think about it like this. Zechariah prophesies solid for 2 years. And then he stops prophesying for like 38 years. And then comes back and prophesies again. So he prophesies as a young man. They rebuild the temple. And then he comes back 38 years later and he offers more prophecies in 480 B.C. That's what we're going to see. So differences in style and references to Greece indicate a date of 480 or so after Darius I and during the reign of Xerxes. Okay, everybody knows Xerxes. Okay, if you've seen 300, he's the big crazy looking dude in 300. Okay, and we talked about this in Sunday school a couple weeks ago, but I don't think he was quite I don't think he quite looked like he does in the movie. That's just my guess. I don't think he was 8 feet tall and golden. but he had cool piercings, yeah. All right, so what happened to Zechariah? Did you know that we find out in Matthew what happens to Zechariah? We actually get, and when I first was studying Zechariah, I didn't even know this. You know, it's one of those things where you just kind of read over it in the New Testament and you don't see what happens. So if you flip over to Matthew 23, we can look and see what happened to him. It'll actually be on the screen too. So if you're that lazy, you can just read it on the screen. That was to convict you of your laziness. All right. Let's look at what it says. Matthew 23, verses 34 and 35. And this is Jesus speaking. He says, "Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall you scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city." So what's he telling the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes? How have they treated God's people? Right? Terribly. Look at what he says there. We sent you prophets. We sent you men of God, and this is what you did to them. You scourged them, you crucified them, you killed them, you persecuted them, you ran them out of town. We've sent you the word of God, and you have not listened. And then look what he says in verse 35. "That upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar." So what did they do to Zechariah? Prophet of God. They killed him, and not only did they kill him, but where did they kill him? And what's it say down there at the end? Where did they kill him? Between the temple and the altar. Why would that be a big deal? Ty, got an idea? What was that? Somebody else, give me. It was in the temple. So why is that a problem? Especially a problem. Not only did they just kill him, but it's even more. Gary? This is in the holy place. So if blood is shed in the temple, what does that mean? That is defilement. That is unclean. That is, remember, you'll see this a lot of times in the book of Acts. I think, remember, we talked about this last year in Sunday school. There was a riot going on right by the temple, and the guards push everybody outside and close the doors because we don't want any blood shed in the temple because this is holy ground. So not only did they kill this prophet of God, but they killed him in the temple. So these are the guys that Jesus is talking to. We sent you the word. You should know. You say you study the word. Have you not read? Has not God said this? You should know this. We sent you guys with the word, and this is how you treated him. This is what you did to him. And he brings up Zechariah specifically. Okay, Zechariah joined Haggai in rousing the people from their indifference, challenging them to resume the building of the temple. Get back to work. Stop building your own houses. Build God's house first. So why do two prophets prophesy concurrently? Why do we have two guys prophesying pretty much the same message at the same time? Well, it's kind of like if you've got two coaches or two teachers or maybe even two pastors in that sense. Are any two people usually alike in how they approach things? No. So what would be the value in having, you know, two teachers and two subjects with very different styles? Different points of view. What else? Yeah, different requirements, different delivery, different style, okay, all that stuff. It's kind of like the whole good cop, bad cop kind of thing, right? Because some of us react much better to somebody like getting up and yelling at us, right? Some of us can really respond to that. And then other of us, if we get yelled at like that, we kind of go into the fetal position and cry in the corner, okay? Like, that's just how it is. And then there's other people where I can be super positive with you, and you'll react really positively, and you'll do the work. And then there's other people I can be really super positive with you, and it doesn't even work, and you don't do the work. You need somebody to yell at you to do the work. You know, we're all different that way. Well, that's what we've got with Zechariah and Haggai. So Haggai is the tough guy. Okay? Haggai is going to come in and lay down the law. Haggai is going to come in. His primary purpose is to rebuild the temple. His preaching has a tone of rebuke. He is the preacher that's going to come in and say, "You are sinning, you are doing wrong, you need to get back on the right track, you need to fix your life, you're messing up. Fix it right now." Okay, that is Haggai. He's going to talk to them about their indifference, their sin, their lack of trust in God. So that's what's going to start the revival. Right? If I come in and tell you, hey, you guys are doing great, but you're not really doing great, like, that's not going to really motivate you to change your ways. So we bring the tough guy in first. It's going to, like, rip you apart and tell you how much you're messing up and how much you need to fix things. And that's going to get you moving in the right direction. But if I keep that guy in there preaching to you for the whole time that you're working, eventually that's going to wear a little thin. So I challenge you, and I get you moving in the right direction, but even when you're doing positive things, I'm still yelling at you. You could get discouraged, right? Does that make sense? So Haggai comes in, rebukes them, gets them moving in the right direction, and when things are going, getting the building going, and the temple's going well, Zechariah follows him up, and he's the good cop. Okay, and Zechariah comes in, strong, positive emphasis. He calls the people to repentance. He reassures them. He gives them hope. Okay, so he's used to keep the revival going. When the things are getting tough, we need a rah-rah guy to come in. And that's where Zechariah comes in. So we're on the positive guy. Last week was bad cop. This week is good cop with Zechariah. And who's gooder than Andy Griffith? yeah. That's right. He's also the most specialist. See, y'all aren't even paying attention. You don't even know how terrible my grammar is. All right. So Zechariah sought to encourage the people to build the temple in view of the promise that someday Messiah would come to inhabit it. He's got a long-term picture on this. It's not build the temple so we can conduct worship services. It's not build the temple because we got to get a sacrifice done next week. It's build the temple because Messiah is coming back here one day and he wants to inhabit this temple. Right? Big picture, looking ahead. The people were not just building for the present. The future hope of the Messiah is in mind. Remember, these people are still under Gentile powers. And they're going to be under Gentile powers for several hundred years now, off and on. Okay? And the Lord is delivering the message that he remembers his covenant promises and that he will ultimately restore and bless them. Because what's going to happen after Malachi in terms of prophecy? 400 years of silence. So don't you think we need some strong prophets here at the end to say this is what's going to happen? Because for 400 years, they're not going to hear from God. And when you think you could get a little discouraged, God's not talking to us. What's going on? Has he forgotten about us? Has he broken his promises? Because think about what's going to happen during those 400 years. After they get back from Babylon, then, you know, Persia's going to come in and run the show, and then Greece is going to come in and run the show, and then Rome is going to come in and run the show. You can imagine how discouraged people are going to get. And so what Zechariah is there to do is say, no matter what happens, you just keep doing what we're doing here at the temple. Messiah is coming. Messiah is going to be here. You're going to be restored. The Lord remembers. That's his name. The Lord remembers you. He's not going to forget what he promised. Okay? Zechariah is often called an apocalypse of the Old Testament, and it relates both to Zechariah's immediate audience as well as the future. Remember, these prophecies, you always have kind of an immediate fulfillment and then a long-term end times fulfillment. So the structure throughout is consistent. The prophet begins historically and then moves forward to the time of the second coming when Messiah returns to his temple to set up his earthly kingdom. So why the structure? It's to remind the people that Messiah had been both an immediate and a long-term commitment to his people. So this Messiah thing, it's not just a plan for the future. It's been the plan from the beginning. We've had it all the way through. We've been telling you about it. You might have missed it. Here you go again. Messiah's coming. He's coming right back here. He's going to inhabit the temple. So these words are comforting to all God's people in all times. So not only does it comfort these Jewish believers right here, it comforts us because we know in the midst of all this garbage, Messiah's coming back. Messiah's coming back. Messiah's coming back. That's the whole idea that Zechariah is trying to get across. It's the most messianic, apocalyptic, and eschatological book in the Old Testament. Okay, which you never probably would have guessed if we just did a survey at the beginning. Primarily, it's a prophecy about Jesus Christ focusing on his coming glory as a means to comfort Israel. Your Redeemer is coming. Okay, so remember, again, we talked about this 400 years. They're not going to get any prophecy. So this is one of the last strong messianic prophecies they're going to get. So let's look at Zechariah chapter 1. We're going to look at one bit of prophecy in terms of the temple. And then we're going to look at a bunch of eschatological prophecy about Messiah. Yeah, Jacob. No, it's God's sovereign plan overall. But if you think about, there was about 400 years of silence before Moses showed up. So it's a similar kind of motif with 400 years before the prophet like Moses that's going to come and redeem everything. So it's, I think my divine opinion on this is that in 400 years of silence, you find out who the real believers are. You find out who the faithful remnant is. And by the time he gets there, that's really all we've got is a core faithful remnant and a bunch of people that pretend to be religious. Right? And so we find out who the core is, who can really take this message on to other things. It's a good question, though. All right, here's Zechariah 1, 13 through 17. It says, "And the Lord answered the angel and talked with me with good words and comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. And I am very sore displeased with the heathen that they are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction." Those are a lot of big words, but what's he talking about there? Let's kind of slow down so we know what he's talking about and get past the King James there so we can understand. Okay, let's look at piece by piece in verse 14. "Cry thou," Lord of hosts says, "I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy." Now, what does it mean that God is jealous for Jerusalem? Okay, we hear that all the time, but I think we just kind of fly right over that. What does that mean? They're his people. Okay, usually we think jealousy with what? You know, yeah, maybe envy what other people have. Think about it, like in relationship-wise, we think of a spouse being jealous or a boyfriend or a girlfriend being jealous, right? Because you're spending time with somebody else or somebody else is giving you too much attention, right? And that's what we've got with God. You are my people, and yet you're worshiping other gods, and you're hanging out in other places, and you're marrying with other people. I am jealous for you. I want all your attention. I want all your love. Okay? Verse 15, "And I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease." So who are the heathen? Yeah, pagan nations, people that are not Israel. And how does God feel about them? He's very sore displeased. How would we say that? Yeah, he is ticked off. He is mad. He is angry. Okay? "I am not happy with the heathen that are at ease, that are comfortable. The pagan nations that are comfortable here. For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction." Why is he really mad at the heathen nations? Right. Not only were they already pagan, they've corrupted Israel, and they've made life worse for Israel, and they've drawn Israel away, and they've abused Israel. He said, "I was already mad at them. Now I'm really mad at them for what they've done to you." Verse 16, "Therefore thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it," that's the temple, "saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem." Because things aren't going so well in Jerusalem, right? They're being persecuted. And Zechariah says, build the house of God. Finish building the temple, and you'll be amazed at what you see. You know, worship me again, and you'll be amazed at what I do, the mercies that I bring to your city. God first described himself as jealous when making his covenant with Israel in Exodus 20, verse 5. Okay? "I am jealous for you because I have chosen you. I've made a covenant with you. I want all your love, all your devotion." The same jealousy has been experienced by Israel in punishment. That same jealous love is expressed emphatically in the city's defense. So when God's punishing his people, he's jealous. When he's loving his people, he's jealous. He has their best interests in mind all the time. Moved by his great love for his people, the Lord acted in anger against the nations, which mistreated his people. Think about that in the jealous sense. You know, a husband finds out that, you know, some other dude's been messing with his wife. He's not going to be happy about that. And he is going to make sure that that guy doesn't cross that line ever, ever again. And that's what God is doing with the nations. These nations were instruments of judgment for God, but his intention was always to punish for a time and then show compassion. So here's the tension that Pastor Sean talks about all the time. We've got pagan nations like Babylon, like Persia. Okay? Does God know that they're going to come and invade Israel? Of course he does. And in a lot of cases, he says, "I'm going to use these guys to punish you." But yet they are still what? They're still accountable for what? The way they do, the way they treat Israel's people. I'm going to use Cyrus. I'm going to use Nebuchadnezzar. I'm going to use Darius. I'm going to use all these guys to correct my people, and yet I'm going to punish them for the sin that they commit when they're doing that. Okay? There's that tension that we've got going on. Okay? It's like the whole Judas example. Judas had to be in there. Judas was going to betray Christ, but is Judas responsible for what he did? Yes. Still is. Okay? That's the tension we always talk about. Not only would the temple, which at the time only had foundations, be rebuilt, but the city itself would again expand due to prosperity. The wall was completed 75 years later. So the temple gets completed in 516. 75 years after that, Nehemiah builds a wall around the city. And we know that that's not what he's talking about. We know that the prophecy has not been fulfilled. Okay? Why? Why is this not the ultimate temple? Yeah, Messiah is not inhabiting this temple. Okay, this temple is destroyed, and it will not be around. So we know that this is a millennial promise. All right, here's what you get in the millennial kingdom. We talk about the millennium a lot during this section. Here's what you get: the presence of God in Jerusalem. We don't see that right now in the sense that we're talking about in this. A glorious temple. Is there a temple in Jerusalem right now? No, there is not. There's a temple mount, but there's not a temple. There's a mosque sitting there. Okay, a rebuilt Jerusalem. The nations are punished. The prosperity of Judah's cities. The blessedness of the people. And the comfort of Zion. The peace of Zion. So that's what we will see in the millennial kingdom. Obviously, that has not come to pass yet. So now we're going to skip ahead about 40 years. And Zechariah is going to prophesy again. That's a cool picture, huh? That's a DeLorean. Yep. Did y'all know I have a flux capacitor in the back of my head right there? Did you see that? I didn't even plan that, but it looks like a flux capacitor. All right, so all I want to do, and this will not take long. We're running kind of short on time. It will not take long. I want to kind of hopscotch around Zechariah and just look at a verse or two here and there and see what Zechariah is talking about for the future. This is hopeful verses. These are messianic verses. That's the stuff that we're going to look at for the last 10, 15 minutes. Okay, Zechariah 9:9. So if you want to flip up there, you can kind of see it in context. But Zechariah 9:9 says this: "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem." So he's talking about Israel here. Okay? "Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly, and riding upon an ass and upon a colt, the foal of an ass." Yep, and we all giggle. Okay? So, yeah, I said colt. I said foal. A donkey. So, think about this prophecy. I just want you to kind of try to go back into your mind and try to go back like you're sitting there in 480 BC and Zechariah comes out and he prophesies and he says, "Thus saith the Lord," and he says, "Your Messiah's coming," and you're like, "All right," and you're like, "Messiah's going to come back, he's going to rule in this temple," and you're like, "Yeah, I like it. Well, how do we know it's going to be him? He's going to be riding on a donkey." Really? Are you sure, Zechariah? Did you not misinterpret that prophecy? Because it doesn't sound very impressive for my Messiah, for my king, to come rolling into town on a donkey. That seems kind of weird to me. How in the world is that going to happen? Well, if we flip up to Mark 11, okay, flip over to Mark 11. And let's listen to Mark 11. Mark 11, verse 1. "And when they came nigh to Jerusalem," this is Jesus and his disciples, "unto Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, he sends forth two of his disciples and said unto them, Go your way into the village over against you, and as soon as you be entered into it, you shall find a colt tied, where a never man sat, loose him and bring him." So go in that city, you're going to find a colt over there tied to the fence. Okay? "And if any man say unto you, Why do you do this? Say they that the Lord hath need of him, and straightway he will send him hither. And they went their way and found the colt tied by the door without in a place where two ways met, and they loose him." So they get the colt and they start bringing him back to Jesus. "And certain of them that stood there said to them, Why are you taking the colt? What are you doing? Why are you taking that? And they said unto them, Even as Jesus had commanded, and they let them go." Oh, the Lord wants it. Okay, go ahead. "Why are you taking our donkey? Because the Lord wants it." Okay, go ahead. You know, it's kind of like those security guards, you know, the bouncer guys at, like, concerts and stuff that think they're all tough. And they're like, "Where are you going?" And you're like, "To the bathroom." And they're like, "All right, go ahead." You know, they don't even put up a fight. Go ahead and take the colt. Okay? "And they brought the colt to Jesus and cast their garments on him, and he sat upon him. And many spread their garments in the way, and others cut down branches off the trees and straw them in the way. And they that went before and they that followed cried, saying, Hosanna, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Blessed be the kingdom of our father David that cometh in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest. And Jesus entered in Jerusalem and into the temple. And when he had looked round about upon all things, and now the eventide was come, he went out unto Bethany with the 12." So Zechariah prophesies that Messiah is going to ride in on a donkey. And what does Jesus do? He rides in on a donkey. Okay? How in the world does something like that just come together? Okay? That just happened. Okay? Now, flip over to Zechariah 12. Zechariah 12. We're going to read two verses in Zechariah 12, 10 and 11. Here's what it says. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hagadrimmon in the valley of Megiddon. Okay? So, look at the specifics there. They're going to look on the one who they did what to? Who they pierced. Okay? Now, why is that significant that Zechariah is talking about the Messiah being pierced? Okay? Now, are they crucifying people in 480 BC? It's not a common practice. It hasn't really even been invented as far as the Romans are concerned. And yet, we've got a very specific prophecy that they're going to look at me, the one that they pierced. How does he know that Jesus was going to be pierced? That's pretty specific. And yet, that's exactly what happens. Okay? And when are they going to know that they messed up? When are the Jews going to know that they messed up? When they see Jesus and they say, "We crucified him." They're going to mourn because they know that's the one. We missed it the first time. Okay? And Jesus is going to come back and reveal himself. Okay? Why will Israel repent? Because they will realize what they've done. They will realize that they missed the Messiah and that Christ is the Messiah. Okay? And we talked about this earlier, but what prophet foretold of this piercing of the Messiah also? Isaiah. Isaiah 53. Okay? He was pierced for our transgressions. Okay. So let's look deeper into the verse and look at what it says. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. Okay, what does that verse tell us? What does it affirm? They shall look upon me whom they have pierced. Yeah, what does it say about Christ? Because who's speaking in this verse? It's Zechariah, but it's not really Zechariah. What's Zechariah speaking for? He's speaking for God, right? Thus saith the Lord. So what's God saying in that verse? What's God saying about Christ? They shall look upon me whom they have pierced. He's talking about himself. So what does that tell us about Jesus? Not only that he was pierced, but that he was what? He was God. Yeah, Jesus is God. God is saying, they will look at me whom they have pierced. So these people that kind of make the argument, oh, they didn't decide Jesus was God until much later. The church invented that so they could... No, we've got it right here in Zechariah. They will look upon me whom they have pierced. God himself was pierced. Okay? It affirms Jesus' godhood, his deity. Okay? It happens again in Zechariah 13, so flip over there. We're going to quickly go through these. Zechariah 13, verse 7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd. And against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts, smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered. And I will turn my hand upon the little ones. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God. So, my shepherd... The man that is my fellow. The shepherd is obviously Christ. And what does God say about the shepherd? The man is my fellow. The man is my equal. The man stands on the same ground that I stand on. So again, we get an emphasis of this is Jesus being co-equal, what we would say, with the Father. Okay? He is God incarnate. He's God in the flesh. Okay? He affirms his deity. Now, who are the sheep that's being talked about? Because we've got two sort of fulfillments in this prophecy. Okay, two sort of fulfillments that go on this prophecy. What could the rest of this prophecy be talking about? What I mean is when it says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man that is my fellow," saith the Lord of hosts, that's Jesus, "smite the shepherd." So what's happening there? That's a crucifixion, right? Smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn my hand upon the little ones. So who are the sheep in this verse, in that sense? It will be later on. Hold that one for a second. But in the immediate one, who is it? I heard Mr. Howard up here say it. Yeah, I heard it over there. Disciples. Because when Jesus is crucified, what happens to the disciples? When Jesus is arrested, what happens to the disciples? Gone. Ghost. Out of there. Who's the only disciple that's there on the, at the cross? John. He's the only one. Remember, we've got Peter, the guy who's just been bragging, I'll never forsake you, Lord. Okay? Denying him three times. All half the other ones, we don't know what happened to them. They were gone so fast. At least Peter hung around long enough to deny. The rest of them were gone. We don't know where they went. Okay? As soon as he got arrested, they were out. John's the only one that hangs around, so the sheep are scattered. When they smite the shepherd, the sheep will scatter. Okay, so we've got that fulfillment. And it says, I will turn my hand upon the little ones. So what we've got there is God upholding them and maintaining them, because when they come out of all that, how would we describe their faith compared to when Jesus is arrested to after Jesus is risen from the dead? The disciples, the faith of the disciples. Stronger or weaker? A little bit stronger. And then we see him at Pentecost. And how would we describe their faith then? Like through the roof. They're preaching like crazy. So we go from Peter denying Christ three times to preaching to the Sanhedrin at the beginning of Acts. The very guys that killed Christ. Okay? Telling them, you guys killed him, and it's your fault. Okay? You need to repent and believe on Christ. All right? So that's one sense. The other part of this is that what's going to happen in AD 70? Big date in Jewish history. What happens in AD 70? Temple is destroyed. Good, you listen to people sitting around you. Okay? Temple's destroyed. Jerusalem is destroyed for the most part. And what happens to the Jews? They get scattered. So what kind of promise does this have for later on? The Jews are now scattered. What's Jesus and what's God promising to do in this verse? One day he's going to do what? He's going to bring them back. He's going to bring them back. He's going to restore them. You're going to be scattered. The temple's going to be destroyed. You're going to be sent all over the world, but one day I'm going to bring you back, and I'm going to save the nation. And that's what we've got going on. Now, last thing, and all I want to do is read this one. We're not even going to really study this one because this is just cool verses, and I want you to hear it. So Zechariah 14. We're going to read 8, 9, and 11. And now we're into the second coming. We're looking forward, and this is what he says. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem. Living waters. That's Christ's words there as well. Living waters shall go out from Jerusalem. Half of them toward the former sea, half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and in his name one. All the land shall be turned as plain from Gibeah to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin's gate unto the place of the first gate, unto the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel unto the king's winepress. And the men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. Now we know that's not the case now, because Jerusalem is not safely inhabited. It is far from it. One day, God will reign in the temple. Jerusalem will be lifted up again, and it will be safely inhabited. It's the comfort of Zion. The peace will come, and that will only come when Messiah comes back. So that should just blow you away, okay? Because it's so amazing when we look forward. So Zechariah gives us immediate fulfillment, serving God by building the temple. 40 years later, he comes back. Because, listen to it, in history, 40 years later, they rebuild that temple in 516. By the time 40 years have passed, Israel has fallen off the cliff again. And they're sinning, and they're intermarrying, and they're pagan stuff. All that stuff's happening again. It doesn't take very long, right? By the time Nehemiah gets there, it's just a mess, right? And so he sees all that happen, and he comes back in 480, and he says, this Jerusalem's important. This temple is important because Messiah is going to reign here one day. And things are going to get bad, but Messiah is going to reign here one day. And things are going to get horrible for you, and you're going to be scattered all over the earth, but Messiah is going to reign. And Messiah is going to come, and you're going to reject him, but he's still going to come back and take care of you because God promised you that was going to happen. That's the kind of message that he's given them in 480 B.C., and he gets very specific with piercing the Savior, with establishing the Messiah as God on earth. Very specific prophecy, and that's exactly what we see. So, next week will be our last... Okay, that's a great movie if you haven't seen it. The last... Yes, if you like Star Wars, you will love Spaceballs. that's Dark Helmet and Lone Star. When they meet, it's like, so at last we meet for the first time, for the last time. It's a great scene. But next week is Malachi, and that will be our last book of the Minor Prophets, the last voice that the Jews will hear until John the Baptist shows up over 400 years later. Okay, so again, next week, think about what you want to study next. Bring suggestions. I'll make a little cute suggestion box and decorate it and stuff and put cool stuff on it. Yeah, there you go. That would be productive. All right, let's pray. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for this evening. Thank you for the book of Zechariah and the